Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Pastor Fred. We're on Perspectives of the Bible. Today we're going to be looking at the Ten Commandments for today. Sorry if this has started a little bit late and you might have been waiting. Thank you for waiting. I appreciate that very, very much. It's snowing here in the greater metropolitan area of New York City. We won't be able to cover the full Ten Commandments today, but we'll give it a try. I want to just make a little editorial comment at the beginning. It's somewhat negative, I think, maybe, but I think it's important to set out the parameters of conversation, at least as far as this show is concerned. I notice that a lot of the people who want to be involved in talk radio have an accusatory nature, and I guess if you have a staff and you have a lot of screeners and you have a lot of people around you who can block those people, because really they don't get through on Hannity, they don't get through on Limbo, they don't get through on Levin, they don't get through on anybody. But on this particular Blog Talk Radio, if you don't have a screener, then you have some choices. You have one of the choices is not to answer calls. That's one of the choices. You don't have to. It might be Blog Talk Radio, but you don't have to. You pay for the program if you have a two-hour program like I do, and therefore, since you're paying for it, you don't have to entertain callers. You might have a smaller audience, but, well, you make those choices, especially if you're just getting all these people who want to blast you and name-call and stereotype and cast aspersions and be nasty. What's the purpose of that? I don't find any purpose to that. Now, the same thing with the chat room. You can have a chat room where people can have a conversation. That means they respect each other, they have pleasant toward each other, they have conversation, not accusation and not name-calling, and they don't seize control of the chat room and all that kind of business. So, the chat room has something called moderator control on it, and you can control the moderation, therefore whatever anybody writes has to go through me anyway. That comes a big pain, because here I am trying to do the broadcast, and then you're trying to do the other, and then you're trying to do the chat. Now people say, oh, you have a staff and so on. Well, maybe you have a staff. I don't. Okay, got it. So let's set the parameters, at least for this program, and I think for all programs, maybe they should have a billboard on Blog Talk Radio with the parameters of call-ins and or chat. Firstly, civility. Let's be civil. There's no reason to even cast aspersions against someone. I don't care if it's even a high-class aspersion, like your boy Bush. I heard that this morning. The person he was talking to didn't have his boy Bush. President Bush, he happened to favor President Bush, and he favored President Bush's policies. But there was no reason for the speaker, who happened to be Imus, to call him your boy Bush. I know Imus does that, and that's his shtick, and fine and dandy. Go ahead and do it. Don't be thin-skinned, Fred. I got it. Now we got people who are going to call in and they're going to ask a lot of questions. What do you mean about this? What do you mean about that? What do you mean? Don't you mean? How mean? And all that kind of questions. Well, if you have questions, then find out. Look on the internet. Listen to previous programs. Most questions I find are accusatory questions. You know, what's wrong with you that you think that way? Prove it to me that you're telling the truth. Listen, I'm not putting myself out here as a god from Mount Sinai. I am one guy in one place. I have credentials. I have plenty of professional experience. I've been around the block plenty of times, so I know where I've been and what I've done. And I'm putting out here at my own dime of what I think. And you can listen to it, or you can agree with it, you can disagree with it. You can if you don't like it, if it really upsets you so terribly much, do what I tell my parishioners. Shut it off. I have people watching this news program, CNN. They watch NBC. They watch whatever they're watching, and they're getting all worked up about Obermann and whoever they're getting worked up about. I said, what are you watching that for? Well, he gets me upset. Well, then I said, either you like getting upset, either you like to watch Keith Obermann, either you like to watch Matthews, and you like them to get you upset, and therefore you're allowed in the present situation to yell and scream at the television and upset your whole entire family. If you like doing that, then stop complaining about them. Shut the door and scream at the television all you want. If you don't like what they have to say, and if it upsets you so terribly, and you get yourself bungeed up in a knot, then shut it off. This is a free country. That television is not wired so it stays on all the time. You have to turn it on. You have to go in the room. You have to listen to those people. And if they upset you so terribly, then shut them off. Likewise, the same thing here. If this stuff is not up your alley, if you don't like it, if you think it's wrong, then you know what? Get your own show. There's plenty of bandwidth out there plunk down the money and get it. And if you can't plunk down the money, get a free half-hour show. Blog Talk Radio allows that. You want to go ranting and raving about anti-this, anti-that, whatever you're against and all this kind of good stuff, go ahead. Get a show. Put it on every day. Get some listeners. Get a following. Do your shtick. Fine with me. Just stay off my program because I'm not interested in all that name-calling, stereotyping, and all kinds of accusatory stuff. Now, just yesterday, I ran into a whole thing after the show where someone called in and said, you know, well, you know, you're wrong, and why are you prying the Bible, and this and that. It wasn't a discussion. There was no way. The person kept saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. That's what the person kept saying. It's no, you're a liar, you're a liar, you're a liar. There's no answer to that, folks. There's no answer. You can't answer that. I can't answer that. Just think I'm a liar, think I'm wrong, and go on your way. I'm not changing your life. I'm not in your house. I'm not banging on your door. I'm not forcing you to listen. If you don't agree, go on. I can't force the church to believe what I believe. I can't force the world to believe what I believe. I can't even force anybody to do anything. So believe that I'm wrong, get on a show, write a letter, put an email, or come out with a cogent argument, a reasonable statement of your position. I found in the 6 or 7 months I've done this program that most attackers don't have a position. They just have an anti-position. They know what they're against. We're against this, we're against that, we're against this, we're against that. It's very much like, let's use a current event example, all those thousands of good people out there in Egypt against Hosni Mubarak. And I'm not taking a position here. I'm just looking at it from a systems viewpoint. Now, all these people out there, down with the government. Now, what does the government do? The government picks up the garbage. The government regulates the streets. The government sees to it that food is delivered. The government protects museums. The government endorses tourism. The government ensures the protection of the biggest industry and trade in Egypt, the tourist trade. Oh, we don't got enough money. We want Mubarak out. Mubarak is the problem. Out with Mubarak. Okay, fine. That's your issue. Do your shtick. Get in the street. Do that. Now, who's going to do it? You? All 60,000 of you, or all 100,000 of you, or all 400,000 of you? No, as one man said, well, we've seized the streets, and we've taken control of the streets, and as one man said in this morning, and now the intellectuals and other organizations will have to make decisions and present them to us. Well, wait a minute. You think you have power? You don't have any power. All you have power is to disrupt. You don't have any power to create. Well, if they don't do what we want, we're just going to stop them. You know, look at communism, find out how that worked. Look at Lenin and Stalin and find out how that worked. Look at the Ayatollah regime in Iran, find out how that worked. You'll find out that the crowds, oh, yeah, they were able to topple the Shah, but they weren't unable to form the government. And so when the Ayatollahs came in and the radical Islamists came in, they just killed everybody. And if you were in the streets, they killed you. And if you were an army officer, they killed you. And if you were the general staff of the Shah, they killed you. And if you were the aristocracy and the academia and all that business, they killed you too. And after they killed everybody, they had all kinds of courts. And after those courts, they had the big, gigantic, like French Revolution, you know, off with their heads, off with their heads. After they killed a couple of, how many people they killed? After they did all that, and then everybody else ran away from the country who had money. A lot of the people out there who had money, middle-class people and citizens of Iran, who were shouting, down with the Shah, down with the Shah, as soon as they saw that the Ayatollahs were in power, as soon as they saw that they were lopping off heads, so to speak, as soon as that happened, all the people with money ran away, leaving the rest of the people stuck in Iran. The Ayatollahs ran around, had all these courts, killed everybody, cut off their hands, cut off their legs, cut off whatever they wanted to do. And once they had established the brutality of their regime, they've been in power ever since. It's going to be the same way in Egypt, folks. Now, calm down, my opinion, calm down and let the government, which has gotten the message, carry out a new government. Back off. Because if you don't back off, the only organization that is organized to take care of it is going to take care of it, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, El Baradei, you know, he's an intellectual. Study the Soviet Union people, I shouldn't call you people, that's disrespectful. My good friends, study the Soviet Union, find out that Kerensky's government and all those good cats, They were intellectuals. They thought, oh, well, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. We don't have to worry about these Bolsheviks. Well, Lenin didn't hear that stuff. Lenin killed people. And then after Lenin got taken care of and Stalin smothered him to death, Stalin killed more people, about 30 million, you know. Maybe between 30 and 50 million if you take certain estimates of the way in which the gulags held the prisoners and like more. So, you know, the people rose up against that terrible, horrible person, the Tsar, and 50 million people died. Well, we'll see how it goes in Egypt. Anyway, if you have a position, if you have something to say, if you have something to contribute, if you have a positive, and you can follow up number one, number two, number three, number four, without asking me all the time, prove yourself, prove yourself, prove yourself, prove yourself, prove yourself. I don't want to. I'm not interested. I'm not interested. So, okay, I've made my shtick here. I made my statement, and you might not like it. I like it, and that's the way I conduct business. So if you don't have anything positive to say, if you don't have anything positive to contribute, if you don't have a position that you want to defend, and if you're in an attack mode, go attack somebody else. I'm not interested. I'm not wasting my time. I'm too old for that kind of stuff. That's baby stuff, okay? We got it straight. Maybe we understand each other. Let's take a pause and listen to a little music, and we'll be back. And if you care to stay with us, we'd be glad to have you. God bless. I'm Pastor Fred, and we're back, and we're going to look at the Ten Commandments for today. And to give credit where credit is due, a lot of my information has been gleaned from a book by Erdmans, William Barclay. You've heard that name, William Barclay, B-A-R-C-L-A-Y, great writer. And his book, I think it might be out of print, but at the time it was in print, it was about $2.25, so that shows you how old this is. This is a very yellowed page book. I grabbed that in my library just last night because I said to myself, you know, I don't know how much new anything I have to say would have to do with the Ten Commandments. Probably very Lutheran. So let's take a look here. Barclay talks about the Ten Commandments in his book. This is by Erdman Press. Let me give you the exact information about this particular book because I like to give credit where credit is due. The Ten Commandments for Today, William Barclay is the writer, and he publishes this 1973. 1973 is the copyright. So this is the foundational piece, and I guess it's still in, I don't think it's in print. I put it on there. I would have put it on the buy list, but I don't see it coming up as something you can buy. Maybe you can get it out of, what do they call that? Used bookstores or something like that. Okay. Maybe on eBay. You know, I put things on eBay for sale. Okay, the table of contents, I think, is always very important. He has, these are the categories he has. The ancient foundation is his opening, and then he has just 1 through 10 commandments. Okay? And we start off, why write another book on anything so ancient as the 10 commandments? Good question. Good question. Why write a book on anything so ancient as the 10 commandments? Can anything new be said about them? He says he has three answers. He says, first, the crisis of the present day is not a theological one. I think that's changed from 1973. I think the crisis of today is theological. You see, I oppose Mr. Barclay. Like I said in my introduction, I have a position. I think it is theological. I don't think anyone has a theology today. I'm not even sure that people have a philosophy today. People have feelings. I feel this, I think this, my opinion is that. And you say, well, what basis do you have for that? Well, I think that. Well, you know, what writer did you read about it? Oh, I don't read writers. Or what caused you to believe that? My father said, or my brother said, or my barber said, or whatever. Okay, fine. That's your position. It's barber theology. Okay, fine, or whatever. Anyway, I have Christian theology of the Lutheran bent, and specifically of the Catholic Lutheran bent, and most certainly a traditional theology of the conservative bent. So there you go. Christian theology is not under attack, he says. This is 1973. I think Christian theology is on a full assault. It's being attacked on every side, and attacked by many so-called Christians who, by their non-attendance at church, their non-participation in worship, and their refusal to train their children in the Christian faith, are saying that they're no longer Christians. They don't believe the Christian theology, or they accept the academic secularists who claim that Christianity is just a religion and not the truth. Of course, if you think that your religious practice is just a religious practice, then you wouldn't believe it to be the truth. But if you believe your religion, then you believe your religion is a true interpretation of reality. A true interpretation of reality. And I can't see a person being a Hindu who didn't believe that Hinduism gives a true interpretation of reality. I can't understand a Buddhist or anybody else, for that matter, a Muslim, believing that Islam is a true interpretation of reality. How Christians can run around with their liberalism and say, we are Christians, but we don't believe that Christianity is a true interpretation of reality, then why are you even claiming to be Christians? Which, sadly to say, many people, less and less and less, are claiming to be Christians. They claim to be nothing. And some think that Westernism or Western Europeanism or Western secularism entitles them to be called Christians because their ancestors were Christians. They're not. Christianity is faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, the Savior of the world. It's a belief in God who actually and really exists ontologically, and it's a belief in the Holy Spirit, who is an eschatological reality that will come to us and toward us from God, you know, and from Christ, and leads us into the future. Okay, that's a lot of fancy theological talk, but that's what I believe. Okay, I said I was going to say that, what I believe. Now, he says, secondly, he said there is the need for this book is there is an element of permanency about the Ten Commandments. He says that ethical systems have their day, but the Ten Commandments remain. Well, yeah, okay, but ethical systems based upon what? Now, you can have an ethical system based on Hinduism. Fine, that's good and dandy. That's nothing. But you can have an ethical system based upon Hinduism. You can have an ethical system based on Confucianism. You can have an ethical system based upon Zen. You can have an ethical system based on African animism. The morality of the religion, whether it's animism, Zen, Buddhism, Hinduism, the morality that comes out of the religion is the foundation upon which you build your ethics, ethics being the application of the morality to everyday and existence. Okay, I don't agree with him on that one either. And thirdly, there is a particular necessity to do this in this generation because in the name of freedom, this generation resents discipline. Now, I agree with that. It does not like the commandments, and it doesn't like commandments of any kind, he writes on page 9. Least of all, it does not like commandments, which are also prohibitions. This generation, written in 1973, mind you, does not like to be told not to do anything. I agree with that. He says, unlimited freedom and unrestricted permission to experiment are the contemporary demands. I think Barclay's right on the money there. In a situation such as this, liberty can very easily become what he calls license or action without rules, I guess you would call it, and it supports the right to experiment, which means the right to wreck one's own life, one's and the lives of others. And I think that's also true in terms of today, when you think that, you know, people have a right to protest. Well, yeah, they do have a right to protest. But, you know, let's look at the protests. We have looting. We have museums being entered and precious artifacts of worldwide importance being destroyed. We have places and situations which are almost world treasures. They belong to Egypt, and I grant you that, but they belong to the whole Egyptian people. And it's not anybody's right to go and chop off the mummies' heads. It's not anybody's right to burn down other people's buildings. And it's not anybody's right to destroy the pyramids and carry off their stones. So, yeah, we have a right to peaceful protest and assembly. That's a Western thinking. Well, that is the application of Western thinking, especially American thinking. But our generation doesn't like that. As a matter of fact, it surprises me how much the American press in the present situation, this is the first day of February 2011, it amazes me how much the American press is supportive of the rioting of other people. So it just amazes me. If I was a store owner and you rioted and burned down my store, I wouldn't be terribly happy about your freedom. Because, you know, I have a freedom to have the store. Oh, but you have the responsibility to respond to our need. Well, yeah, I am responding to your need. I'm offering you goods and services for sale. Well, we don't want to pay your price. You're too expensive. You are mean-spirited because you don't give it to us for free. You have all the money and we have no money, so we're going to take what's yours. We're going to steal it. Breaks the commandments. And it also is a contributor to the disintegration of all social interaction and leads to chaos. And chaos leads to the rule of the strong and the suppression of the weak. And the weak, oftentimes, are the ones who start the chaos, and they end up being the victims of the chaos. It's quite amazing. Okay, let's take a pause here, and we'll come back, and we'll go back into William Barclay's book on the Ten Commandments, looking at some of the things he has to say. Okay, I'm Pastor Fred back. We're back on the Ten Commandments. We're looking at William Barclay's book called The Ten Commandments for Today, Timeless Truths for Today's Moral Issues, Gaining New Insights into Current Problems, published by Erdmann's Press, and it's published in 1973 as the publication. So there you go. William Barclay wrote the preface. We just talked about that from the University of Glasgow. Maybe you need to look up whether he's still alive. I'm pretty sure Barclay's dead. I wouldn't think he's alive. Okay, now, he talks about the ancient foundations, and he said Christianity, he's a Christian, did not come into the world without roots and foundations. There was in history a preparation for the coming of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ himself said that he did not come to destroy, but to fulfill, Matthew 5:17. There was already something there, out of which Christianity emerged and upon which it built and could build. This, of course, was Judaism. Well, yeah, it's called Judeo-Christianity, and we all acknowledge, and even the Protestants acknowledge that we come from Judaism. And you can see some kind of cute evidences of that if you look at Roman Catholicism. You know, the Pope wears a little beanie. It's like a yarmulke. Well, that's where it comes from. The priests wear headdress, you know, like the bishops do. That comes from the Old Testament priesthood. That's where that comes from. Many of the robes and official regalia of Roman Catholic priests, bishops and archbishops and popes, have their connection to the Old Testament descriptions of the priestly garments of the Aaronic priesthood. So, yeah, Judeo-Christianity. And the services, the liturgy, we talked about that in the previous program, the liturgy of the church. If you look even today at the present structure of a synagogue worship, you will find enormously large parallels between the way in which Jews worship within a synagogue and the way Christians worship within a church. So, yeah, we definitely are based upon and come out of the roots, which is our common root in the Old Testament, out of Judaism. He goes on then to say at the end of that, that Judaism comes out of what he calls the universal laws of human conduct known as the Ten Commandments. Now, Judaism would probably, I'm not a Jew, so I can't say, but I would probably say that Judaism would at least grumble a little bit about saying that these universal principles preexisted them, because the Old Testament says that they received the Ten Commandments in the form that they received them directly from the hand of God who wrote them. They're written on the tablets of stone by the finger of God. It's very much the assumption of the Old Testament. Okay, let's look at what the Ten Commandments are. If you want to, okay, let's go. Let's have a little test. What's the first commandment? Well, okay, you shall have no other gods before, Barclay adds, or beside me. Okay, the second commandment. Now this, if you're a Lutheran, you're going to have a little trouble with this one. Well, Barclay says the second commandment is, you shall not make for yourself a graven image. You shall not make for yourself a graven image. Now the third commandment, according to Barclay, is, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. See, the Lutherans would probably throw the third commandment of Barclay into the second position, and they would subdue or submerge the second commandment, you shall not make for yourself a graven image. Okay, number four, what's the fourth commandment, which for the Lutherans is the third commandment? remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Okay, the fourth commandment, or for the Lutherans, the fourth commandment for Barclay, the fifth commandment. I'm not going to do that every time. We'll just go on from there. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And then the next one, honor your father and mother, which Luther adds, in order that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth, which Luther calls the first commandment with a promise. The next commandment, you shall not kill. Simple. My Lutheran seminary professors preferred to translate that in a modern way to say, you shall not commit murder. I think that's an interesting nuance there. The next, you shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet. Now, obviously, you have the first three sections, which actually even refer to God. The first three sections, you shall have no other God before me or beside me. The idea of beside being that there were other gods. I mean, the people of the time, you know, especially the Jews, well, let's look at a little bit of the time. You had all kinds of gods. You had the gods of the Baalim, the Asherah. These were the cosmic gods, the gods of weather, the gods of thunder and lightning, sort of indistinct gods, you know, not. They were sort of universal in a certain sense, the Baalim and the Asherah. And they were the fertility gods, you know, the imagery of the Baal was the male god with the sperm and the ejaculation and the penis, and the Ostara, the fertility god with the breasts, and the idea is that what you involved yourself with in the Baal worship and the Ostara worship was that you went out into the warm places, the high places, the groves, and the platforms that were set up, and you conducted sex acts under the sky. Whether you did it with each other, whether you did it with a cult prostitute or a male cult prostitute, either one of the two, you were involving yourself with getting the god, Baal, all excited. You were the Ostara, the earth, and you were getting the god Baal all excited in order that he could get an erection, and then he could spill out his sperm all over the world, which was the rain, and thereby bring fertility to the earth. So pretty primitive thinking and a direct connection between human action being able to elicit a particular response or desired response from the god based upon if you did this and you did it right and you did it often enough, then the god would respond, ejaculate, and rain, and everything would be fine. You'd get the crops, all that kind of good stuff. A further development in Baal Ostara worship was the intimate identity of the person with the god. In other words, when you had sex with the male cult prostitute, it was like having sex with the god. And if you had sex with the female cult prostitute, and there were plenty of them, you know, you went in, you had your sex, you paid your money, you were having sex with the god. And so you were joined together with the god by the sexual act, and that had an element of divinization for you. You joined yourself to the male, or you joined yourself to the female, who were representatives of God, and, you know, you can carry it on, you know, if you want to get into the gross details of what goes on at the climax of sex for the male and the female, then you can see how the god dwells in the one and all that kind of good stuff. Well, that's all part of cult prostitution, which was at the time. Now, I got into that fundamentally because it plays a big part in Old Testament thinking in the sense that there isn't always a thorough denial of the existence of such gods and goddesses. It's almost like, yes, they are false gods. They're gods, but they're not the gods. And they're gods, but they're not the true god. They're the false god. Or they're gods, but they're not the powerful gods. They're the not-so-powerful gods. Now, connected to that as well is the idea of national gods. In the time of the Old Testament, you had the local god and goddesses of the individual nations, like Moloch and Chemosh and Astarte and Osiris and all that. Ra, you know, the Egyptian god Osiris, the Egyptian god Ra, the sun god. Again, these are local god and goddesses directly related to the nation. And talking about Egypt, Akhenaten, who was an Egyptian pharaoh who believed in monotheism, got himself in big hairy trouble with the priests of the various gods and goddesses and temples. Places of worship, because they, you know, said there were many dozens of gods, and each one of them represented one of those gods and got paid and all that kind of good stuff. And he said, no, there's only one god, and all you guys are phonies. Well, or minimally, your gods are inferior to my god, the Akhenaten god, and to Ra, really. That's, I think he was really a supporter of Ra over all the other gods. The thing about local gods is that these local deities were circumscribed by the environment of the nation, so that Moloch and Chemosh and all those kind of gods, nasty gods, by the way, Moloch demanded child sacrifice. I think Chemosh did, too. And one of them, you can correct me, look it up on the internet, I think one of them was very much either Chemosh or Moloch or one of those kind of guys, gods, according to the thinking, if you wanted to have a safe house and a fecund house, and if you want to have a healthy house, I think you took the firstborn female. I don't think it ever happened to a male, but you took the firstborn female child, infant, and you put them into a jar. You shoved them into a jar while they were still alive, and you buried them under the doorpost of the house. It was a nasty, nasty business, most certainly. So I guess you take your baby, you put it in the jar, you put the lid on the jar, you seal the jar, you dig a hole, you put the jar on the ground, and the kid dies, hopefully in a day or two. Just so amazingly horrendous. But that was the guarantee that the house had safety and good health, and that all other children born into that house would be okay, and all that good stuff. That's even reflected somewhat, if you want to go into that, in the idea that all firstborn males issued from the womb belong to Yahweh, and they must be redeemed. They must be redeemed. They have to be purchased back from God. They belong to God. So I guess Chemosh and Moloch people would say, well, we're not doing anything different than that. We just don't allow redemption of the firstborn female. She has to be murdered, and that's the way we see it. So Barclay, in his little translation here, is basically saying, okay, you will have no other gods before or beside me. Either way, there are no other. I am not only the greatest, I am the only. And that's the assumption of the first commandment. Okay, it has an important part to understand what they were thinking at that time and what a lot of people might think of today. You know, is God the God, or are there many gods? Is there the money God? Is there what other kind of God? Pleasure God? Maybe there is a pleasure God out there. There's so much. Maybe there's a beauty God, you know, the Hollywood God, the God of beauty and excellence, of beauty. Maybe there's a six-pack ab God, and the perfect breast God, and the excellent face God. I don't know. Depending, since people conduct their lives in such a way as to please these things, perfect abs or perfect body or perfect face or perfect boobs or perfect sex act or whatever it's going to be, maybe that which they serve is their God. Maybe that's the way we want to see it. And maybe that is the way that it is, actually. Okay, let's take a pause here. We'll take a little break. We'll be getting back to Barclay's comments on his book, The Ten Commandments for Today. Stay with us. Okay, this is Pastor Fred, and thank you for staying with us or just tuning in or archiving or whatever you do, and I appreciate it so much. I put out an effort here to make a contribution to discussion and dialogue, or at least to thinking. Barclay, in his book here, which we're reading from, the sections of it, Ten Commandments for Today, William Barclay, 1973, Erdman's Press, an interesting point on page 13. He says, the Ten Commandments are a series of principles and not a body of detailed rules and regulations. I think that's an important distinction. They, namely the Ten Commandments, do not attempt to give a man a series of rules ready-made to apply to any and all situations. What they do give a man, or a person, is a certain attitude toward God and toward his fellow men. Fellow people. You can see he was non-sexist language. That's okay. We understand that. We're big boys nowadays. We have to play around with that, correcting it all the time, although I find myself doing it. Our circumstances may change. The situations may alter. What remains constant is the attitude of reverence toward God and respect for man. That reverence and that respect may be expressed in different ways at different times and in different situations, but the expression is always the expression of the same fundamental attitude toward God and toward man. The Ten Commandments say, and here he quotes, "Here is how you ought to feel toward God and toward man. In each separate situation, in each separate situation, work out the expression in action of that feeling for yourself." In other words, in this Jewish ethic, which is the foundation of the Christian ethic, there is ideally an unchanging attitude with an infinite flexibility in the expression of it. Isn't that beautifully? Let me say that again to you. In other words, in this Jewish ethic, which is the foundation of the Christian ethic, there is ideally an unchanging attitude with an infinite flexibility in the expression of it. Now, this is so very important to have a foundation. You know, whose God do you have anyway? You know, I talked about this a little bit yesterday. People say, it's me and my Bible and my Jesus. It's me and my Bible and my Jesus. That's what Billy says. Then Johnny says, well, it's me and my Bible and my Jesus. And then Mary says, it's me and my Bible and my Jesus. And then it's the other person, the fourth person says, it's me and my Bible and my Jesus. And I get to ask the question, not an attack question, but just a discussion, a conversation question. Well, what Jesus do you have? Is it the Billy Jesus and then another Jesus called the Joel Jesus and another Jesus called the Mary Jesus and another Jesus called the Jane Jesus? Well, they say, no, it's the true Jesus, you know, the one that Pastor Bob says or the Pastor Billy Bob or Pastor Dr. Frederick says or whatever. Well, you know, it's the Bible Jesus. It's the Bible Jesus, verse 17, and then another verse, verse 84. Well, yeah, but who says what this Jesus is about? Who expands on that? Who explains it? Who philosophizes about it? Who theologizes about it? Well, it's my Jesus, my Jesus, my Bible, and my truth. Well, then I guess all religion is subject to the individual's like and dislike. You like this, and I like that, and you like this, and I like that. You're right, and I'm right, and he's right, and she's right, and everybody's right, therefore nobody's right. You know, there are places whereby you need to have a rule, such as the Ten Commandments. You will have no other God in front of or beside me. You shall not take the name of the Lord God in vain. You shall remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, and the like more. That's the foundation stone upon which you build the application. So I'm going to take a little pause here for a little bit longer time, but I think he has a very big point in the very beginning, and that is to say, let's read it again. This is on page 13 of his book. In other words, in this Jewish ethic, the Ten Commandments, which is the foundation of the Christian ethic, there is ideally an unchanging attitude, with an infinite flexibility in the expression of that attitude. Okay, I think that's very, very good. Let's take a pause. We're going to take a little bit longer pause here, and we're going to see, let's listen to our song about Jesus. I think that's so beautiful. And that way we can all take a little bit of a break. And stay with us. I'll be right back.
Oh.
Okay, we're back. Ten Commandments for today, the first day of February, the year 2011. We're looking at William Barclay's book, The Ten Commandments, for today. I know I didn't list it in the books to be purchased because I'm pretty sure that this book is out of print. It's a great book, though, so if you can get it in the library, you might want to take a peek at that. Okay, now let's go on to the Second Commandment. He deals with the Second Commandment, which in this case, let's look at what he says. You shall not make for yourself a graven image. You shall not make for yourself a graven image. And he starts off with a very interesting and exciting comment. He says, an idol is a paradoxical thing. In one sense, there is nothing more unnatural or even more ridiculous than an idol. Interesting. Isaiah pours scorn on the man who makes an idol. He makes a piece of wood, and with one bit of it, he makes a fire to warm himself, and with another bit of it, he makes a fire to cook his dinner, and with a third bit of it, he makes a god. So he takes his tools, and he designs and measures and cuts and carves, and the resulting product of his own hands is his god. Now the idol is there, incapable of movement, fixed to one place as fast as a scarecrow in a cucumber field. When, in the day of war, a town is invaded, the citizens flee from it, staggering under the weight of their idols, their gods, that they are carrying on their shoulders. There is no more savage and scathing indictment of the gods who are no gods than in the 73 verses of the little book of the Apocrypha called the Letter of Jeremiah. Very interesting. Now, you know, I agree, of course, I agree. However, I don't know. I think we're a little bit rough on people. I really think we're rough on people. I don't like to be even tough on the pagans, you know. And I know that the Hindus, for instance, have 6,000 gods. And I've been to some Hindu festivals, and they have the elephant god, and they have. And you say to them, "Do you worship this god?" And they say, "Well, no, we don't worship this god." Well, and the more intellectual Hindus will give me all kinds of explanations about why they have 6,000 gods. I know it sounds relatively gross, you know, I mean, to bow down in front of wooden descriptions of things and phallic symbols and all that, which is very much part of Hinduism, Vedic Hinduism. Just read the, what is it, Suma Sutra, whatever the thing is called. I've seen it. I don't know. I've seen it. It's quite graphic. Okay. Anyway, having said that, I do want to say that if a person really wanted to believe, like he says, they carry their gods with them, well, let's say Christianity. I have a church, and I have a beautiful cross here. It's made of brass, and it's valued maybe a couple of years ago at about $300. It's valued today at about $4,000. And what am I going to do with that? You know, now if I have an opportunity and things have, you know, give me some time, I will gather up those pieces of art and valuable religious expression that I have, and I'll carry them with me. Now, in my church, we have gigantic stained glass windows, which, you know, we put in about 30 years ago, probably paid about $6,000 or $7,000 per window, and now they're probably worth about $100,000 per window if we could replace them. So I can't carry the art glass with me. It's impossible to do. But I can carry the cross. So I probably will carry it with me. And maybe somebody will say, why are you carrying that heavy cross with you? You have to flee from the enemy. Is the cross your idol? Well, no, it's not. Because we understand, and maybe other people do understand as well, that the symbol is merely the representation of, or the representation of, the item that stands behind it, and that we don't worship the wooden idol, we worship the god who stands behind the idol. Now, I know that one of the things that people do when they go in, and, you know, Islam will do it, maybe Christianity did it at one time, other religions have done it in conquerors, so they go into the religious sanctuaries and they smash the statuary and they smash the crosses and they melt down the silver icons and all that kind of stuff in order to eradicate the religion and to show that they and the boot of their warriors is stronger than your god, who cannot defend itself against being busted up, broken up, burned down, and melted into Igots. Well, yeah, okay, it makes you feel good about that. And there are lots of folk, you know, I guess there's lots of folk who want to get wrapped up in that. We had a big debate just recently arguing about whether or not we should be allowed to build a Islamic mosque for the Muslims on the site of the World Trade Center, or very close to the site of the World Trade Center, and there's a big hubbub and crying you about that. And understandably, in the sense that Islam does have a traditional expression of itself where it says that wherever it conquests, wherever it conquers, it turns their place of conquest, they mark the place of conquest with a mosque. And in the terms of the Twin Towers, we could see the position of some people who claim that, well, you know, hey, the people who were on the planes were Muslims, they practiced Islam, radical Islam, and they believed in jihad, and they decided to destroy the World Trade Center and 4,000 people. Potentially, always remember, I think there's a thing, I just want to make this an aside here. The intention of the Islamic jihadists was not to knock down some empty buildings. That was not their intention. The intention of Al-Qaeda, which backed the Islamic jihadists, many of them Saudi Arabians and Egyptians, who were on those planes on that day in September 11, their intention was not to take an empty building and make it into rubble. Their intention was to strike at the heart of America and to strike at the heart of Christianity, and they regarded the World Trade Center as the hub of the financial center of Western Christianity. And they intended to kill everybody in it, and they knew that potentially they would be able to kill upwards of 50,000 people in one stroke. 50,000. And then you want to add to it the intention of them to strike the Pentagon and kill untold thousands, because it's a place that has thousands and thousands of workers. And then you add to it their intention to strike at the Capitol building, which maybe wasn't so much the people, even though there would be hundreds and hundreds of people, and legislators and leaders. So depending on the time of the day, if they could have carried it out in such a way, they might have killed off 20 or 30 or even 50 or 100 of the key leaders of the nation. See, all of it to produce chaos. That they didn't is not as much the point as what they intended and why they chose those specific sites. And it's very, very disingenuous of us today to go and say, well, you know, they didn't really kill 50,000 people, so it wasn't a bad thing. It was only sort of kind of a bad thing. And they didn't kill all the Pentagon leadership, so it wasn't such a bad thing. You know, and they didn't really knock off 100 or 200 congressional representatives, so it wasn't really a bad thing. They never got to. Hey, remember what their intention was. Their intention was to strike at the heart of your country, to strike at the heart of your nation, to destroy your leadership, and to throw your country into chaos. And in some respects, in the days after 9/11, at least in the New York metropolitan area, they did throw us into not chaos, but they did regulate our behavior because of what they had done. Our behavior was regulated in such a way as to protect ourselves, but in another sense, they achieved much of what they wanted to achieve, which was not only the knocking down of this symbolic building. Why do we say that? And why am I going into 9/11? Well, because it has something to do with the way in which we regard things, in the way in which we think about what people do and don't do. Now, I'm willing to say that idol worship conceptually is, if a person is worshiping a wooden statue as a wooden statue, as though the wooden statue itself was a god, well, that would be pretty primitive, to say the least. But, you know, you have people, like I said, who worship youth, who worship six-pack abs. We have all these magazines with six-pack abs. We have all these magazines with breast implants and all that kind of stuff. We have all these weight magazines that have to be svelte and to be thin and to be... We have all these youth culture to idolize worshiping youth and to be young and to be glamorous and to be Hollywood-y, all that kind of good stuff. And hundreds and thousands of people dedicate their time and their effort and their talent and their money to accomplishing the, what should we call it, the style of life. Now, Christianity and Judaism are the same. We want people to idealize us. We want them to imitate us. We want them to abide by our values. We want them to live a lifestyle which is Jewish or Christian. And we want them to dedicate their time, their effort, their talent, and their treasure to the pursuit of these things as opposed to the other things I just mentioned. That's why we have the religion as opposed to the secularist religion. And maybe there is such a thing as secularism, which, you know, my home pastor, and I think he was right, I used to say that all isms, anything you can attach ism to, and when it becomes an ism, it's a religion. You know, that's very interesting thinking. I think that's very interesting. Well, okay, we dealt a little bit with Barclay, what he had to say. Let's just take a moment. We'll have a little stop here, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Pastor Fred. We're back. We're going to move along. I'm very surprised. I guess using Barclay's book was a good idea. Again, we're reading little excerpts, and we're commenting upon William Barclay's book, The Ten Commandments for Today, Timeless Truths for Today's Moral Issues, Gain New Insights into Your Current Problems, William Barclay, Erdman's Press, 1973 was the publication. Okay, so you can get it out of your library or that more. Okay, now, he says the third commandment is, thou, or you, should not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And he says the main question is, what is the meaning of in vain? That's a very interesting question. What is the meaning of in vain? Now, what do you think? What is the meaning of in vain? He says here the commandment is a prohibition of taking the name of God in vain, in a promise or a pledge, that is, of making such a promise or a pledge in the name of God with no intention of keeping it, or of making a promise in the name of God and then afterwards breaking it because it was inconvenient or uncomfortable to keep it. So this is a condemnation, this is on page 25, this is a condemnation of the man who takes a pledge in God's name to do something, who then breaks his pledge. Now, that seems so very simple. It really does. I wonder what he has to say about that. I would probably stop right there. But, okay, he has a lot of points. You can look at that. He says, well, my goodness, what is he going to say about this particular point? He goes, okay, on page 27, he goes on that he says, let us then look at all the promises we make and must keep. Let us look then at all the promises we make and must keep. There are the ordinary promises and undertakings of life, such as we promise to do this, or to see that, or to be there, or to go there, and we do that again and again, and that promise is broken, and normally we think nothing of it. Oh, that's interesting. That is really interesting. And that's true. Oh, I promise to see you. I might have to cancel. I'll tell you right now. I might have to cancel my... I have a show on at 2 o'clock today, broadcast. I might have to cancel that because of the weather and because of my schedule, which will not allow me to probably keep that program. I will have to cancel that program and reschedule that particular program for tomorrow. I sort of, by putting it up, I made a promise that I would have it, and now because of circumstances, I am changing that promise and asking you for your understanding. Okay, secondly, he says there is the promise which is implicit in every contract of work. There is the promise which is implicit in every contract of work. When we enter into any contract of work, our employer undertakes to give us so much money, and we undertake to give him our work. Now, that's a whole, you know, we can go into the whole thing about the laborer is worthy of his hire, and then you and I have been workers. You know, we know some people are paid hundreds of millions of dollars to be CEOs and CFOs of major corporations. I oftentimes wonder why. Many other stockbrokers and financial people who are savvy on how to play the finance game also make hundreds of millions of dollars, and I also wonder why. Then there are the working people. You know, some working people are paid more than other working people. I don't wonder why so much there, because I think in the ordinary sense, the middle group, you and me, we are graded upon our ability. You know, some people can do carpentry, others cannot, and some people can do excellent carpentry and others cannot. Some people can do excellent stonework and other people cannot. I'm talking mainly trade. Some people can repair commercial jet airliners and other people cannot. And think of that as an instance, and I think they're underpaid, by the way. I find it interesting that people who are basketball players who play basketball or play football or play baseball are paid hundreds of millions of dollars, and then these same people who pay hundreds of millions of dollars get on an airplane to take them to a particular place, whether they're a $100 million Hollywood actor or a $100 million basketball star or a $100 million football star or a $100 million baseball star. They put themselves onto an airplane. The mechanic of that airplane was probably paid $75,000 for the year, and he or she is responsible for the maintenance of that airplane and the safety of it. So the guy puts himself on a plane. The mechanic who keeps that plane flying is paid $75,000. And the pilot who flies the plane is probably paid $100,000 a year. And so you have, maybe if the whole team is on the plane, maybe if you have 10 guys at $100 million apiece for their contracts, you have $1 billion worth of people on a plane, and the guy who fixes the plane gets $75,000 a year, and the guy who flies the plane gets $100,000 a year. Now, that is really absurd, but people do it all the time. It's quite amazing in the contract of working. And I don't know how that applies to this commandment, but anyway, okay, let's go on. Now, thirdly, he says there is technically something else, which is the promise in a law court, and the promise before God, by the name of God in this case, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And so, do we tell the truth every day? I think that's an interesting thing that Barclay will call attention to. But at least in terms of the court, we promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God, that means as best as we can. It's kind of funny when you think about it, you know. The whole truth, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, as far as I am able to remember the truth. Interesting thing. I like to use the illustration of language and perception. And I've used this in previous programs, but to me it's very important. You have a red car and a white car, and they have a collision at a corner. And the guy on the far corner says, the white car hit the red car. And the one on the near corner says, the red car hit the white car. And which one of the two is correct? Well, actually, both of them are correct because the cars had a collision. The decision as to which one of the cars hit the other car. Now, one person says the red car hit the white car. One guy says the white car hit the red car. Now, what they're doing is they're making a slippage in judgment based upon their perception. They perceived, and for them it was the truth, that the red car hit the white car, or the white car hit the red car. The reality was is that one car hit the other car. They had a collision. Neither car hit the other car. They collided. That's the unvarnished truth. And then a decision has to be made as to how that happened and who might be culpable for the collision. You see, but the two bystanders who are outside of the action, although they're eyewitnesses to the action, they make a judgment based upon their perception of reality, which for them is the truth, as to who is to blame. When they use the word hit, white hit red or red hit white, you see. So language is a very, very tricky business. And when we deal with that, we have to deal with the application of the words, I will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And then we add, so help me God, which is to say, to the best of my ability. And I guess that's why we have jury trials. And so we can see what the truth is in a broader and bigger sense. Okay, let's take a little stop here just for a minute. We'll be back in a few seconds, and then we'll continue on with William Barclay's book and are looking at the Ten Commandments. Hello, this is Pastor Fred. We're back. We're looking at William Barclay's book, The Ten Commandments. We're up at the fourth commandment already, surprisingly enough. And you'll be surprised because the fourth commandment is, according to him, let me read it to you, on page 31 of the book by put out by Erdman's, William Barclay's book. Set out in full, the fourth commandment says this, quote, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your manservant or your maidservant or your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, it's interesting. He spends, you know, in the previous commandments, four pages, 2.5 pages, 3.5 pages for the first three commandments. You would think he would have a lot to say about those, but he doesn't. When we get to the fourth commandment, I'm looking at page 31 where it starts. I'm at page 45. He hasn't even, in 14 pages, he hasn't solved what he considers the problem of the fourth commandment. It seems that he has an issue with it. He just can't figure out what it means. What does it mean to keep the Sabbath day holy? So Barclay uses 14 pages of material to talk about all the different interpretations of what it means to keep the Sabbath. And then he says, how shall we keep the Lord's day? Now, here's number one. This is on page 45. Ought we to observe and keep any special day at all? Well, the commandment seems to say there's a day, and on that day you will stop working and you will do worship. And Barclay deals with that. I think there should be a day. I think it says that is a day. And the second point he says is, what should we do on that day? What is the purpose of that day? And is a day of rest still necessary in our world? Do we need such a thing? And then going on from there, he has quite a bit of discussion about that. 13 more pages, my goodness, to deal with whether or not we should have a Sabbath day. It's quite amazing. It's a great discussion. Much of it has to do with the history of people and what they have believed should be the definition of keeping the Sabbath day holy. And I'm just going to look at page 52. Remember we started on page 31 with the fourth commandment in the book. We're already at page 52. What a discussion he has here. Now, he says, for the Christian, the Lord's day should be used for worship. The word worship is a very wide word. Worship is worth-ship, and to worship is to confess and to experience the supreme worth of God. It is through some means or other to find the presence of God, and through that discovery to find the inspiration and the strength to live a life which is fit for the presence of God. William Temple's definition of worship places worship in the wider context which it ought to have. To worship, Temple says, is to quicken the conscience by the holiness of God, to feed the mind with the truth of God, to purge the imagination by the beauty of God, and to open the heart to the love of God, and to devote the will to the purpose of God. Interesting. I like the words. I don't have any idea what he's talking about. I have to tell you, we're dealing with a lot of stuff here. In the simple sense, it seems to me, and this is, again, my opinion, that the commandment is relatively easy to understand. It says that there is a day, and on that day, people of the Christian faith and the Jewish faith, because it's the Ten Commandments for the Jews. Of course, we believe it's the Ten Commandments for everybody. But, you know, in our day and age, you don't apply the Ten Commandments to the Hindus. You don't apply the Ten Commandments to the Buddhists. You don't apply the Ten Commandments to the Zen Buddhists. You don't apply the Ten Commandments to the people who practice Shinto and so on. So we're just talking about the Jews and the Christians here. The Ten Commandments, as applied to them by modern understanding, means that they are to have a particular day on which they stop working and which they use to worship God in community, which goes to synagogue, goes to temple, go to church, not sit home and eat bonbons and drink coffee and read the paper. You know, it's amazing to me how many Christians, so-called, do not attend church and automatically break the Sabbath day, and automatically, quote-unquote, sin. Yeah, that's exactly right. So I'm a Christian, but I don't have to go to church to be a Christian, but the commandment says, honor the Sabbath day. How do you do that, dear friend? Oh, I stay home with my kids, you know, I have a bakery, I have donuts and coffee, I read the papers, and the kids read the funny papers, and we have a nice at-home day. Well, that's nice. That's very nice. But that's not what the commandment says. It says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Holy. And holiness is that which applies to God. And holiness, as applies to God, if you look in the book of Revelation, in the entire book of Revelation has to do with worship. You know, in heaven are the 24 elders and the beast with eyes up and down and around and so forth. We're going to do a study in the book of Revelation in the coming weeks, so be staying tuned for when we start the project. I want to do a lot of writing and a lot of research before I broadcast such a series as the book of Revelation. But in the simplicity of the fourth commandment, it would seem, at least to this person, that it's relatively easy. Whether it's a Saturday or a Wednesday or a Sunday doesn't really make any difference in that sense, but that it be a day in which the Christians stop working, pay attention to God, pray, meditate, read the scriptures, and gather together for public testimony and public witness and public worship. The word is public. You know, a lot of people say, you don't have to go to church. I don't need church. Well, maybe you don't need to go to church. That's very true. Okay, you don't need to go to church. But maybe somebody else needs to see you in church. Maybe there's somebody depressed. Maybe there's somebody going to commit suicide. Maybe there's somebody who's just had a tragedy. Maybe there's somebody who's fearful. Maybe there's someone who's doubting. Maybe there's someone who's just feeling lonely. And they go to church. Hopefully, they go to church because they want to pray, of course, and they want to worship, of course, but they would like to see you too. And maybe if you were there, they would talk to you. Maybe if you were there, they would confide in you. Maybe if you were there, they would share with you. Maybe if you were there, just by seeing you, they would be encouraged and delighted. And so maybe you don't have to go to church. Maybe you're such a strong super Christian. Maybe you're such a strong super person that you don't need the community. But you see, the community needs you. And people inside of that community need you. There may just be old people. I have a congregation of older people, and they need to see younger people. When they see younger people come to church, they are encouraged. The younger people attending church, maybe they don't need to come to church for themselves, but the older people need to see the younger people in church. So your mission in life and your purpose in life is to spend that hour in church in order thereby to bring encouragement, to bring hope, to bring comfort, to bring a sense of continuity to older people who are a lot closer to death than you are. So give a little and sacrifice a little and share a little and stop being so selfish. Maybe you need to go to church to bring counsel to someone. Maybe there is someone thinking about committing suicide. You don't know who's thinking about that. Maybe there is someone who's having a great turmoil of conscience or tension of conscience, anxiety of life. And they need somebody to talk to because everyone they're involved with is involved in their problem, and they need somebody outside. They can't afford a counselor. They don't want to go to the pastor because they're embarrassed. They can't afford a professional psychiatrist and psychologist. And so they go to church, and they have conversation, but you're not there. And maybe you have experience in that area. Maybe you have experience of the same type of thing that they're experiencing. Maybe you can help them get out of their trouble, to overcome their anxiety, to quell their fear, to rise above their depression, to move on with their life. Maybe you can do that. But you see, you're so selfish because you don't have to go to church. I don't have to go to church for myself. You're so selfish that you don't put yourself out there so that the possibility exists that you might help somebody. You stay in your home, and you eat your donuts, and you drink your coffee, and you read your paper, and you indulge yourself. Well, how about a little sacrifice? Jesus sacrificed himself on the cross for you. Get out there and help somebody. Maybe there's a youngster in the congregation. Maybe there are more youngsters in the congregation who need to see men and women who are strong in church. You know, people's need role models. And I think of a lot of young men, you know, young, personable, outgoing, athletic, strong, intelligent, all the good stuff, people who abandon the church because, well, they don't need the church. Well, maybe you don't need the church. Okay, fine, you don't need the church. But maybe there's a young boy who's having a problem with his life. Maybe there's a young 7-year-old who needs a role model. Maybe there's a girl who needs to talk to an older girl who's only a teenager. Maybe there's a teenage girl, 11, a tween, who needs to talk to an older girl because she's facing all the pressures of her sexuality and her social standing in school, or maybe she's being mocked in school, or maybe she's being picked on in school, or maybe the neighborhood kids are taunting her, and she needs to go to church to meet people where it's safe and where it's secure and where she can be helped. So all of you folk out there, I don't have to go to church to be a Christian. Fine, fine, fine. You don't have to go to church to be a Christian. But other people need you to go to church because you have a job to do and you have a purpose to carry out and you have a role to play. So stop being so selfish and gazing on yourself in the mirror and admiring your own beauty and indulging yourself in your own laziness and get up your dukkahs and go to church and help people. That's what it's all about. A little strong there, Pastor Fred, but that's how I feel. I just think it's way, way, way too much indulgence, especially in the Protestant churches, where the Protestants are priding themselves. Oh, I don't have to go to church to pray. Fine, don't go to church to pray for yourself. Go to church to pray for somebody else. Oh, I don't have to go to church to worship. Well, fine, don't go to church to worship for yourself. Be there in church to be an encouragement, a role model, a helper, a counselor, a comforter, an assister, a friend, a partner to somebody else. Stop thinking about what you don't have to do because you don't have to do it because you don't have to do it because you don't have to do it. Get over yourself. Church is about other people. Church is about helping other people. Church is about being a friend to other people. Church is about embracing and befriending and encouraging and loving and praying for and working with and partnershiping with other people. So, yeah, fine and dandy what you don't have to do for yourself. Fine. Be glorious in your own self value. But get off your couch and go to church and help other people. No matter whether they're 96-year-olds or 6-year-olds. They have a need to see you in church. You never know what God planned for you. My goodness, think of it that one day you die and you go to the heavenly gates and God says, let me open the book of your life. And he opens the book and he says, you know, I'll just even use one year, the year 2010. Let's say, I'm not wishing for anybody to die today, but let's just say that you're one of these folk who say, I don't have to go to church to be a Christian, therefore I do not go to church. And you die. And 10, January to December. And he says, you know, there were 52 Sundays that I planned. God saying to you, I planned for you on the first Sunday of January to meet Mary Jane and to help her so that she didn't commit suicide. On the second Sunday of January, I plan for you to meet Mrs. Smith, who's 95 years old and wondering whether it's worth living anymore. On the third Sunday of January, I plan for you to meet Mr. Jones, who is having a terrible problem in his marriage and wondering if there's any way in which he can save the relationship with his wife. On the fourth Sunday of January, I plan for you to be there when a little 7-year-old boy who just doesn't believe anymore and is beginning to lose a grip on himself needed to talk to another boy, maybe you in particular, and you weren't there. And then on the first week of January, the first Sunday of January, I plan for this little girl who's only 11 years old, who's being taunted, who's being Facebooked and mocked, who's being torn apart in school, who's being ridiculed by her peers. She needs to talk to some other girl who can help her. And you were supposed to be the girl that she was supposed to talk to. But you know what? You weren't there. You missed the boy, you weren't there. And you missed the girl, you weren't there. And we're only on the sixth or seventh day of 52 days of the year. And what God will say to you is, you did not even accomplish the simplest tasks that I gave you. All you did with the life that I gave you is to spend it on yourself. You see, Christianity is to be committed to other Christians. It's to be committed to other people. It's to get out and to help and to encourage and to embrace and to advise and to be a role model and to be a supporter and a helper and embracing. I don't know what to do. There's plenty to do. Just go to church. You'll find plenty to do in church just by being there. Let's use another example. There are people walking up and down the street saying Christianity has no meaning, no purpose. It's meaningless, purposeless, because the churches are empty. And you, maybe you do have a Christian feeling. Maybe you do have a Christian idea. And you're saying to yourself, I don't have to go to church to be a Christian. Well, maybe you don't have to be in church to be a Christian. But other people who are losing their Christian faith, who do not believe in God, who are being led to hell, need to see you fill the pews of the church on Christmas, on Easter, and on every Sunday. The story is told that Leon Trotsky, who was in the United States, or it might have been Lenin. Now I'm going to have to figure out which one it is. I think it might have been Lenin. But anyway, he was in the United States. I think it was Trotsky. And he was in the United States, and he decided to give it a chance, and he went to a church. And he said, my goodness, this church holds 150 people, and there are barely 50 people in it. This is the time of Trotsky. This is way in the 1915, whatever the days are. You'll look it up. It's a great story. But you get the point from the story. And he says, my goodness, this can't be a very important religion because nobody's here. They claim to have thousands of adherents, and there are 50 people in a room that holds 150 people. Can't be very important. And so they said that we're going to have a Bible study. And so they had a Bible study, and there were five people in the Bible study. And Trotsky said, what happened to the other 45 people? Oh, they went home to have their donuts and coffee and read their newspaper. Well, he says, it can't be terribly important, this study of this Bible cannot be very important if these people would rather go home and eat their donuts and drink their coffee and read their paper. That is more important to them than studying this Bible. And so your attendance at worship, your attendance in the church, your attendance in the pew is a witness and testimony to Christ. Now everybody says, oh, what can I do for Christ? What can I do for Christ? I can be born again. That's nice. You're born again. Run around and say, oh, you're born again. What do you do to show it? Well, I live a good life. I put my garbage pails out. I scoop up my dog poop. I mow my lawn. I stay home on Sundays and study my Bible in the privacy and the secrecy of my own little closet room and all that good stuff. Hey, get out. Walk the church. Carry your Bible under your arm, wear your cross around your neck, and make it clear by your dress that you're on your way to church. That's giving testimony, and that's being born again. And when you get to church, don't grouse about the pastor. Pray for the pastor. And when you get to church, don't grouse about the other people that they're all hypocrites and phonies. Bow your head in prayer and say, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, like the publican did and not the Pharisee. And then when you're in the worship service, listen to what the pastor has to say. And then after the service is over, listen to what other people have to say and listen to their needs and seek out opportunities to encourage them and support them and pray for them. And then when you go home, walk home in your Sunday finest, with your Bible under your arm and your cross around your neck, making it crystal clear that you've been to church, smile at people. Say, good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. Let them see that you're a happy Christian. And when you get home, don't sit around the table and say, oh, the pastor was lousy and the sermon was lousy and the people were lousy. And so that your children hear this kind of garbage and are turned against the Christian faith by your activity and by your grousing and by your action, which is not Christian. When you get home, say, oh, it was such a great experience. I loved singing the hymns. One of them was one of my favorites. And maybe one of them was very difficult. Forget about mentioning it. Just say, you know, I loved singing that one. It was a great one. The pastor had an insightful sermon. I loved meeting the good people. I feel so good. You see, that's doing something for the Lord. And if you can't even do that, then maybe you're not a Christian, you see? And I mean this whole statement on the fourth commandment, to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as an adjustment, especially to the Protestants, who insist that church going is not important. It has no meaning. It's just something we do. It isn't something we do. I had a woman, I served the church in Kingston, New York, and she, this is a true story. It's, you know, you would think I make this stuff up, but it's all true. She was a wonderful woman. She came to church every Sunday. She came to Bible study every Sunday. And she's there one Sunday, and she's all flustered. And good-looking woman, lived in a good, look, a nice neighborhood, had a couple of bucks for herself, and she always kept herself in a nice way. She was a, you know, kept together, put together person. And she said, you know, Reverend, she told the class, she stood up and told the class, she says, you know, something really strange happened to me today. And we said, well, what was it? And she said, well, when I came out of my home, I have quite a bit of a walkway to get to the car, and as I was walking down the sidewalk, my neighbor came running out and stopped me and said, I have to ask you a question. And I was startled, and so the person in the Bible class continued by saying, I was startled, and the woman said to me, well, I see you every single Sunday for the last months and months and months going to church every single Sunday, and you seem to spend 2 or 3 hours at church, and you come home, and I want to know, why do you go to church? And the Bible study member said, I really don't know why I go to church. I just do. I guess it's a habit. Now, I'm not going to rail against that. I'm going to say that that's sad. Not so much that the person really was going to church from habit. I think that's false, and it's unnecessary to make that conclusion. Not necessarily that the Bible studier and the worshiper was just doing it by rote, but that she didn't realize what she was doing, and she had never even considered the possibility that her going to church was a testimony, was a witness, was a public witness, was a public testimony to the Lordship of Jesus Christ in her life, which indicated the importance of Christian faith for her and her family. Like Joshua says, as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord. She never got that concept, and that was sad. I mean, that's sad. I don't want to judge her, but I want to point it out because, you see, for the non-Christian or the non-believer or the lapsed Christian in the house next door, she saw all that public action as encouragement. And she was moved to leave her house, approach the Christian, and ask the Christian, why do you go to church every Sunday? And sadly, this good Christian woman flubbed it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that her actions did, in fact, inspire the other person. And maybe the other person, although disappointed by the Christian's answer, may have still tried it out for herself and said, well, that's a stupid answer, but I'm going to try it myself. Since this woman seems to be getting something out of it, I'm going to go to church and see if I can get something out of it and maybe even put something into it as well. You know, that I said something just now that I don't like to say, which is go to church to get something out of it. Yeah, that's true. We all do get something out of church. But the thing we should get out of church is what we put in to help other people and to encourage other people and to assist other people. That's a long story about the Fourth Commandment. I didn't go into the same kind of topics as Barclay did. I think that Barclay got wrapped around the day issue, whether it should be this day or that day. It's, like I say, it's about almost 20 pages on just the commandment and what about the day, and should we have a day or not have a day. Okay, fine. That's good. Now we're going to take a little pause, and then we'll get back, and we'll finish up this little section. I don't know if we'll get to the Fifth Commandment, but we'll wrap it up for today. And I thank you for listening. If you're archiving this, I appreciate that, and I hope that and God will bless you from this program. Please stay with us for the wrap-up. That's Jacob's Ladder we're listening to, and I know that it's a fault here of mine that I don't have the artist and the label and the title and all that good stuff so that I can give proper credit to that, so I shut it off. It's a great rendition of Jacob's Ladder, by the way, fantastic. And I have it on one of my CDs here, and I don't want to get myself in a copyright problem, so I do want to give the guy his credit, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to do that, so I better watch my step. But I will mention the CD because I think you should have it. I notice here on the Blog Talk Radio stuff that you can't really advertise the CDs. I have a great number of CDs that I would like you to listen to and that you would like to buy. I mean, I sell some of them on eBay myself, as a matter of fact. I have about two or three cases of brand new CDs that I offer there for about $1.99 plus $3 for shipping, which, you know, for a $17 CD is a pretty good deal. And there's some really great stuff out there. These are brand new CDs and shrink wrap, never opened, and all that kind of stuff. Okay, the books I put on there, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I have a Sue Monk kids book on there. Great book. Get that book. It's very insightful, very easy reading. It was assigned to me when I was doing my doctoral work at Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia in one of my classes on Christian biography, as a matter of fact. It was a summer class that I was taking as I worked toward my doctorate. And great book. I've enjoyed it immensely. Sue Monk, what have we got here? I don't have it in front of me. So, well, you can see it in front of you, so you know which one we're talking about. Then the book on the Creed by Luke Timothy Johnson. Great book. Awesome book. If you want to read a book about the Creed, right up there with Pope Benedict, in my opinion. Great book. Well worth the read. You'll read every page over and over again because of the great insight that you get. Click on that one, too. It's worthy to have it in your library. And then the book on the Holy Spirit by Sproul. Another great book, a little bit older book, and R.C. Sproul there, he does a great job on that particular book. I think it's worthy of having. Again, you can get them in your library. You can buy them at any one of the big major bookstores, or you can click on Amazon.com there. If you click on Amazon.com right now, you'll get a price. You know, how it comes up. It comes up with brand new, $17 and so on. And then, you know, used, 14 available from $6 to whatever the price is. A great deal. I buy most of my good books brand new, but other books, like some books, you know, if you don't have the money, you buy a used book. If you don't have any money at all, you go to the library and get them, and you read them. Great books. I recommend them highly. I'd like to be able to recommend CDs as well, like this Jacob's Ladder one, and some of the more upbeat spiritual works. I'd like also to mention my blog on here. I do have a blog. It's called BibleStudyForEveryone.com, Bible-study-for-everyone.com. It's a different than what I'm doing here. I do have a lot of material on there about various parts of the Bible, the New Testament books of the Bible, the Old Testament books, mainly the New Testament books. And then I have a very extended amount of material on current events in the blog. The blog part, which is the current events section, is mainly dealing with the Vatican and or the Orthodox Church and somewhat with Protestantism. Now you say, why don't I have much about Protestantism? Well, Protestantism isn't doing anything. It doesn't make a statement about any theological issues. You know, it doesn't make much statements about any current event issues. It doesn't make any statement about any kind of ethical, moral issues. It's pretty bland out there for Protestantism. So, you know, oh yeah, Reverend John's church and Reverend Bill's church and Reverend and Sister Anne's church is having a bake sale. Well, fine, you know, that's good. I'm not going to cover that in an international blog. This is an international blog. That blog is read in Russia, and I have, I can track, not the individual person, but I can track the locality And about 60% of the people that read that blog are United States citizens, about another 5% are Canadians. Then I have about another 5% of South Americans, so that brings us to about 70%. And then the remaining 30% are Russians, South Africans, Kenyans, Tanzania, all kinds of places, Sri Lanka, Senegal, the Seychelles, I guess it is, and so forth. Amazing, and I'm very happy to be able to put that out. And so I deal mainly with the Vatican because they have the most news, and also with the Orthodox Church. The Greek Orthodox Church is there, and especially the Roman, Russian Orthodox Church. A huge amount of motion and movement in the Russian Orthodox Church. Quite amazing how the outreach of the Russian Orthodox Church has increased since the fall of communism. Now, here's a success story if you ever want to have one, a church under persecution in Russia, the Orthodox Church, a church where the priests were rounded up and sent to the Gulag and exterminated in the Gulag, the Russian Orthodox Church, a church that suffered the martyrdom of many of its people in the 50 million people pogrom of Joseph Stalin, 50 million people in the pogrom of Joseph Stalin and the Gulag of Joseph Stalin and his successors up to and including Khrushchev and the like, and Chernoff and those cats. And then survive that. And then the church is taken away and turned into cattle stalls, and its monasteries closed down and confiscated by the government. Its schools closed down and burned down by the government. Its people harassed and suppressed and forbidden to worship by the government. For 70 years, the Russian Orthodox Church was persecuted by the communists and stomped down and burned down and beaten down and mega martyrs, 50 million plus. And then communism was put down by God and turned over by God, and the Western evangelical community gathered together and decided that what they had to do was they had to run into Russia and convert the Russians. And not the communist Russians. No, they had to run into Russia and convert the Orthodox Russians. Now, these are people who have been, as I've just described, persecuted constantly and mercilessly for 70 years, and the arrogant, self-centered, self-serving, self-righteous Western Protestants went running over there with their Bibles and started shoving their Bibles under the nose of the Orthodox and say, "Let us save you. Let us make you born again." Now, how would you feel if for the name of Jesus, if for the sake of Jesus, a church which had been founded under the Rus in Kiev, you know, in the year, my goodness, what year was that? 400 or 500 A.D.? Do and testify to the name of Jesus all those many years, and all of a sudden you come out of this great persecution by the deliverance of God, and these Protestants who never even were persecuted for 1 minute come running over and they shove their Bible in your face and they say to you, "Let us save you." I don't think that makes for friendship, buddy. I don't think so. Anyway, I cover that quite extensively as I'm able to. And it's a great story of the resurgence of Christianity, Orthodox Christianity in Russia and the former Russian empire, the communist empire in the Eastern Bloc nations. A great story of resurgent seminaries, resurgent vocations, resurgent worship, resurgent congregations, planting new congregations, and also the resurgence of the Baptist Church in Russia, another church that was mercilessly persecuted and stomped down and kicked down and destroyed, and how that church is thriving. The Baptist churches, the Russian Baptist churches, thriving and evangelizing and missionizing and out there facing secularism and the new secularism. Wonderful, wonderful. And Roman Catholicism as well, although to a lesser degree. A great story there about God's deliverance of the church of the Russians and of the communists, delivering them out of their persecution into a new day of a new evangelization in the Soviet Union. Wonderful story. I have some of that on my blog at bible-study-for-everyone.com. Also, I have a radio station, which is mostly music, almost completely music at this point, which is Christian Church Radio, ChristianChurchRadio.com. Click on that. You know, I could use a couple of clicks, guys. I don't know if we're succeeding. We're trying to succeed. I just need to know that I have an audience out there who clicks on occasionally. So if you go to ChristianChurchRadio.com, you click on the MP3 player, you listen to the program a little bit, you'll get a statistic in there. I won't be able to track you. Don't worry about that. I'm not going to send you any emails. Don't worry about that. I'm not going to bother you with the, you know, all kinds of bother. But you can do something even today to support a brother Christian by going to ChristianChurchRadio.com and or BibleStudyForEveryone.com and just clicking on, spending a little time on the site, 15 seconds, 15 minutes, and that way you'll be helpful. And we'll have done something today. I thank you for that. Now, I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to have to, if you're thinking about this afternoon's program, I will have to cancel that program, going right into the site here and canceling it in the next minute or two, because I have to. I just don't have the time to carry that out. But I do intend to carry out a prayer call-in program. Maybe that will be tomorrow's program, a prayer call-in program. Well, probably not tomorrow, because I'd like to work on the rest of Barclay's comments on the Ten Commandments tomorrow, Wednesday, so I'd have to go to Thursday maybe, or Friday at the latest, to deal with the prayer call-in program. It's a very important ministry, I know, so I'll just have to come up with the conclusion. Maybe tomorrow I'll do the prayer call-in program and put off the Ten Commandments until the next days. Okay, this is Pastor Fred. You're listening to Perspectives on the Bible. Today's topic was the Ten Commandments for Today, a commentary on the book by William Barclay, The Ten Commandments for Today, put out by Erdmann's Press, 1973. And I want to thank you for listening. I hope you'll stay tuned. And if you're archiving this or have archived this, thank you very much for taking the time to call it up and to listen to the program. God bless you and keep you. God makes his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. God lifts up his countenance upon you and give you his eternal peace. Thank you for listening.
Hope, fear, and courage.